At this point in the ministry of Jesus, three groups came to him: the Pharisees, the Herodians, and the Sadducees, the three leading parties of the time. And each of these groups asked a leading question of Christ. And by asking the question, they provoked a controversy. And their intention, in fact, was to trap Jesus by getting him to take sides on one issue or another. They wanted Jesus to declare himself, because they knew that however he declared himself, he would land in trouble. Only two of these groups are mentioned in Luke chapter 20. But if you read the parallel passages in Matthew 22 and Mark chapter 12, you will see that there were in fact three groups. First of all, there came the Pharisees. They were the traditional conservatives of the day. They were accompanied by the Herodians, who were the men whose religion was all mixed up with social and political issues. And the question of the Pharisees and the Herodians was, is it right to pay the poll tax to Caesar? A very relevant question, may seem. If Jesus had said yes, he would have offended the Pharisees, because they resented the Roman occupation. If he had said no, he would have offended the Herodians, because they backed the Herods, who were the agents and the puppets of Rome. But Jesus avoided Sylla and Charybdis. He said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. The second group was made up of Sadducees, and they brought the imaginary story of this poor woman who was married to seven brothers in turn. What they are speaking about here is the practice of Levirate marriage. And the law of Levirate marriage was this, that if a man died and left a wife and no children, his brother was under an obligation to marry the widow and raise up children bearing the man's name. And this meant that the man's name did not die out in Israel. And you can read about the law of Levirate marriage in Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 5. And I ask you to turn that up now. Deuteronomy 25 and verse 5, Levirate marriage, which I'm happy to say no longer exists. John will read it for us.
If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother will go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his brother who is dead, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to
perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, and if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, and pull his sandal off his foot, and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him that had his sandal pulled off.
Aren't you glad that law has died out? The most famous example of it in the Bible is the story of Ruth. When Ruth came back from Moab with her mother-in-law, Naomi, Naomi set about the business of finding the nearest relative to Ruth's late husband. It so happened that the man refused to perform his duty. And the next nearest relative was Boaz. And so Boaz married Ruth, and the two became the ancestors of Jesus Christ. And the Sadducees ask, if such a woman marries seven brothers in turn, and they leave no children, whose wife shall she be in the resurrection of the dead? Now, the irony of the question was this. The Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. Their question was purely academic. They did not believe in the supernatural. They scarcely believed in the next life at all, and they certainly did not accept that one day the dead would rise. Contrast verse 27 with verse 33. Verse 27 says, there came to him some Sadducees who say that there is no resurrection. And verse 33, in the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? My first observation is this. If you stand back from this passage and look down on these men and their academic questions, an important principle stands out. And it is a principle that is relevant for all of us. And it is this. Don't play games with Jesus. Because that is what these men were doing. They were fooling around with Christ and with eternal issues. And if you do that, sooner or later, you are bound to lose. It was, I think, Moody, the great evangelist of last century, who said, play with lightning, play with fire, but do not play games with God. And that is the principle here. These men were playing games with Jesus. They were fooling around with God. And that is one of the most dangerous things that you can ever do. You notice that throughout the chapter, these men come to Jesus with their questions. Is it lawful to pay the poll tax to Caesar? Whose wife shall she be in the resurrection? And later on, the lawyer who asks, Master, which is the greatest commandment? But you see, Jesus can ask questions too. And right at the end of the chapter, Jesus asks his question. And he quotes the opening verses of the 110th Psalm. If you look on to the end of the chapter at the 41st verse, Jesus said to them at the end of all their questions, how can they say that the Messiah is David's son? For David says himself in the book of Psalms, at the 110th Psalm, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make thine enemies a stool for thy feet. David thus calls him Lord. So how is the Messiah David's son? Now the point about Psalm 110 is this, that the two words for Lord in the opening verses are two different words in Hebrew. The first, Lord, capital L-O-R-D, is the word Jehovah. It is the fatherly, covenanting name of God. The second word, Lord, capital L, little O-R-D, is the word Adonai, which is the worshipful and respectful name of God. And in the Old Testament, Jehovah is what God the Father is in the New Testament. And Adonai in the Old Testament is what the Lord Jesus Christ is in the New Testament. Jehovah and Adonai in Psalm 110 are Father and Son. And so the opening verses of the 110th Psalm portray a conversation between Father and Son. Now, says Jesus, if David calls the Messiah Lord, Adonai, how can the Messiah be David's son? And they could not answer him. And the moral is, again, don't play games with Jesus. Sooner or later, you are destined to lose. And I'm bound to say there is scarcely an area of life in which you cannot play games with Jesus. You can play games with Jesus in respect of your conversion to Christ and your basic salvation. I say this kindly. Some of you here today have been playing games with Jesus for many years. You keep postponing the day of decision. You are playing what is called the mañana game. You intend to come to Christ, but you do not intend to come to Christ today. Tomorrow, next Sabbath, next week, next year, you intend to come to Christ before you die, "My friend, you are fooling around with Jesus. You are playing games with God." It is possible to fool around with Jesus in the matter of consecration. If you are a Christian, you may be aware that there are bad habits in your life, and you would like to get rid of them. You know that there are leanings and propensities in your nature that are hindering your growth. And you know as a Christian that you ought to deal with such things. And you keep postponing the day. Tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, you'll get down to the business of tackling your private failings. My friend, you are fooling with Jesus. You are playing games with God. Did you know that Moses was kept from setting foot in the promised land because of his ungovernable temper? You see it in the way he murdered the Egyptian taskmaster. From that incident, he learned nothing. You see it in the way he struck the rock in rage in the wilderness. And from that incident, he learned nothing. And it was because of his uncrucified anger that Moses was allowed to see the land, but not to enter. How easy it is to play games with God. That is what these men were doing. They were fooling around with Jesus. They were trifling with eternity. The second great principle is this. Jesus tells us that there is no marriage as we knew it in heaven, in verses 34 to 36. Jesus said to them, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are accounted worthy to attain to that age and to the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, for they cannot die anymore." And if you take that as a normative, that there is no marriage as we know it in heaven, Jesus is telling us two things about the next world, and he's telling us two things about this world. Let's start with the next world. First of all, what he's saying is there is no sexuality in the next world as we know it in this world. Now, of course, Jesus is not saying that human sexuality is wrong or unworthy. There is nothing wrong in being men and women. There's nothing wrong in men being men and women being women. That is a creation ordinance of God. It is written in the book of Genesis concerning human sexuality. Male and female created he them. The Bible does not say male and male created he them. Nor does it say female and female created he them. Male and female. Jesus is simply saying that in the age to come, the distinctions of sexuality are subordinate, and maleness and femaleness disappear in heaven, and we become like the angels. I think you should hold on to your seats for the next remarks. As a matter of interest, angels in the Bible all have male names. Gabriel and Michael are male names. When angels appear on earth, they take the form of handsome men. When the angels appeared to Abraham, they came as three good-looking men. Gideon, when he was visited by an angel, saw a man. It was only much later that the Victorians invented lady angels with long hair and flowing robes. Very soon, your Christmas cards will be arriving. You might find it interesting to go through your Christmas cards and have a good look at the angels and see which of them are men and which are women. The lady angels on your Christmas cards are Victorian fancies. The male ones are nearer the Bible image. That doesn't mean that God is chauvinistic and biased towards men, because in fact, he tells us in his word that in the age to come, there are no such distinctions. There is no marriage as we know it in heaven, and there is no sexuality as we know it in heaven. And the second thing that Jesus teaches about the next world is this. There is no need for marriage in heaven because there is no need to perpetuate the race. That's the point of verse 36. They cannot die anymore. Here in this world where men die, the institution of marriage is given for the procreation of children. As the marriage service says, marriage has been given to us by God for the continuation of family life, so that little children who are the heritage of the Lord might be brought up in the fear and admonition of God and trained in godly living. In a world where there is no death, there is no need for marriage to raise up children. Heaven is a place in which there are no cemeteries. There are no hospitals. There is no death. And because there is no death, the need for marriage and for the procreation of children disappear. They cannot die anymore. But as well as saying something about the next world, Jesus is also saying something about this world and about marriage here and now. And there are two principles and lessons that stand out. The first is this. Because there is no marriage in heaven, that does not mean that marriage on earth is a second-rate thing. It does mean that here in this world, we should not entertain too high expectations of marriage. I am persuaded that the high divorce rates today, and there are areas of the country where one out of every three marriages ends in divorce. I am persuaded that the high divorce rates today are partly due to the fact that men and women enter marriage with expectations and with dreams that are far too high. Did you know that until comparatively recently, when people married, they did not have views of marriage which assumed that marriage was the answer to all their problems? Marriage is not the answer to all your problems. Jesus Christ is the answer to all your problems. And many of the silly, romantic views of marriage that have been forced upon folk today by television and by the electronic morality of television. All that whole romantic philosophy fostered and plugged by the media and the entertainment industry, especially the world of love songs and pop songs with their inane, fatuous statements about love and marriage, all of that is utterly unbiblical. Marriage is not the answer to all your problems. There are people who think that marriage is the answer to human loneliness. It is not. You can be married and lonely. There are people who think that marriage is the answer to your emotional problems. It's nothing of the sort. You can be married and have emotional problems. And the view that is pushed is that marriage is an ideal state. It is nothing of the sort. Marriage is not an ideal state. Marriage is nearly ideal if you're called by God to be married. Celibacy is nearly ideal if you're called by God to be celibate, because marriage and celibacy are both vocations under God. Some people are called to be married, and some people are called to be single. But there are no perfect marriages. You sometimes hear people say, "Oh, I had a perfect marriage. I had a perfect husband. I had a perfect wife." And you know what they mean. They fell in love, and they stayed in love, and there were no serious ruptures in their relationship. But a perfect marriage? A flawless marriage? Perfect mince and tatties all the time? Perfect steamed puddings all the time? A perfect holiday in Spain when he wants to go to a bullfight and she wants to go to the Prado? perfect winter evenings by the fire when it's snowing outside and somebody has to exercise the dog. There are no perfect marriages. Marriages were never intended by God to be perfect. You can have a lifelong, happy, loving relationship. But even if all marriages were absolutely perfect, you would have to face the fact that every marriage ends in death. And death is God's way of divorce. Every marriage ends in divorce. That's the first principle. We should not set our expectations too high. And the second principle is this. Do you know the word utopianism? Utopianism is the idea that you can have heaven on earth. And there are many people who believe that you can find heaven on earth in marriage. That is not a biblical notion. You can have earth on earth. You can have heaven in heaven. And if you belong to Jesus Christ, you can have foretastes of heaven on earth. But you can't have heaven on earth. I've invented a new name for this. I call it Edenism. Edenism is the desire to get back to the Garden of Eden and to the innocence and the happiness of the first perfect marriage between Adam and Eve. N.S.C. and MacDonald was saying to me on Friday evening that the present collapse of Marxism and communism throughout the world is God's judgment on utopianism and Edenism, the longing to make heaven and earth and have the Garden of Eden all over again. It cannot be. Did you not know that in the book of Genesis, God has barred the way back to the Garden of Eden with cherubim carrying flaming swords? That way to perfect happiness is closed forever. You cannot get back to paradise. Edenism and utopianism are under the judgment of God. And surely you know what the word utopia means. It's a Greek word. Means the happy land. The only happy land I know is not in this world. The happy land is in the world to come. One last point. Jesus says that in heaven there is no marriage as we know it. Well, there's no marriage as we know it for another good reason. Heaven is all marriage. And that is why human marriage disappears. Because when marriage with a capital M has come, marriage with a little m disappears. When the great reality comes, the little shadows vanish. And when the greater marriage comes, it swallows up all the lesser marriages. According to the Bible, the marriage of the Lamb to his bride, the church, is the climax of history. And down here in this world, we are invited by the gospel to prepare for that marriage. As the old preachers used to say, this world is engagement country. This is betrothal country. Now is the time to get engaged to Christ. But up there is Beulah land, marriage country. Are you engaged to Jesus Christ? Are you affianced to him? Are you betrothed to Christ and united to him in trust and in love? This is engagement country. This is betrothal country. The girl says to her sweetheart in the Song of Solomon, my beloved is mine, and I am his. Can you say that in your heart today? My beloved is mine, and I am his. It is your passport to heaven. It is your wedding invitation from Christ today. Do not refuse the invitation. Amen. May God add his blessing to the preaching of his word. To his name be honor and praise. Hymn number 651. And after this hymn, we remain standing for the first verse of the national anthem. 651, forth in thy name, O Lord, I go.